Hello, and welcome to today's VJ Hemonc podcast. We are a global, open access video journal bringing you the latest in hematology and hematological oncology. In today's podcast, you will hear from experts Maury Gertz, Ashutosh Wakelekar, and Daniel Lenihan, who discuss key updates in the management of amyloidosis, emphasizing the importance of cardio-oncology. Several topics are covered, including the importance of accurately diagnosing amyloidosis, currently available therapies, how to manage cardiomyopathy, and the importance of the multidisciplinary team.
Good day, and thank you for joining us for this important VJ Hemonc presentation on diagnosis and management of amyloidosis. We're fortunate today to have two experts joining in the VJ Hemonc program, Professor Ashu Wakelekar of the National Amyloidosis Center of Great Britain, and Daniel Lenihan, Fellow American College of Cardiology, Cape Cardiology Group, Cape Girardeau, Missouri. With that, I think we're going to just dive right into some of the important issues surrounding amyloidosis. And I think the first is a hematology-specific question that I'll direct to Professor Wakelekar. Ashu, amyloid and myeloma are similarly treated. Why is it important to distinguish the two and make the diagnosis of amyloidosis? Why is it important to differentiate?
I think, Murray, that's an important distinction for two reasons. One is a lot of patients with amyloidosis may not have active myeloma with end organ damage. So these may be patients just with a monoclonal gammopathy of uncertain significance, otherwise with an end organ damage or a smoldering myeloma. But more importantly, these patients have significant end organ damage of heart, nerves, kidneys, in a way which is quite different to myeloma. The clone of plasma cells in these patients is not as malignant, so the response to treatment is very different. And the long-term outcomes can be very different depending on the depth of response that is achieved. So a myeloma patient may do reasonably well with a partial response, but an amyloid patient will carry on progressing their end organ damage with a partial response. And then the last aspect, I guess, is the supportive care that these patients need is also significantly different from a myeloma and amyloidosis perspective. Hence, the distinction becomes important from a diagnostic and prognostic perspective.
Are there certain myeloma agents that we don't regularly use in patients with light chain amyloidosis?
Indeed. I mean, the agents which we would not use regularly would be agents where there is significant toxicity to the end organs. For example, carfilzomib is a drug which is used in myeloma quite a lot, but used in amyloidosis quite rarely. Immunomodulatory agents like thalidomide and lenalidomide, which form a lot of backbones of myeloma therapy, are again not used in amyloidosis that frequently because of toxicity and end organ damage. Pomalidomide, which is usually used in relapsed refractory myeloma, can be used in amyloid, but with a great deal of caution and monitoring. Similarly, selection of patients for an autologous transplant is quite critical in amyloidosis based on end organ damage. Whilst with myeloma, most younger patients would still have an autologous transplant as a standard of care after completion of the induction treatment in myeloma.
Thank you. Dr. Lenihan, why is early diagnosis important? What's the impact in your cardiology practice when a patient has a meaningful delay in arriving at a correct diagnosis?
This is a super important question. And if there was anything, any message that I would want to convey from this presentation would be, you really need to consider AL amyloidosis as a cardiac emergency. So if you're suspicious of it, you need to do the evaluation, whatever's necessary to make the diagnosis definitively and as quickly as possible. And the reason is that, and I'm sure you and Ashutosh will talk about these types of details, but you know, depending on the stage of disease where you make the diagnosis of AL amyloidosis, it has a huge impact on overall outcomes. So if you wait until it's very obvious to everybody that AL amyloidosis exists, then at that point, you know, your chance of meaningful treatment response is very low. So the cardiac manifestations are so important. And if you can catch it before there are any real cardiac manifestations, then the outcome of your treatment is much better.
What do you see as the barriers to a diagnosis of cardiac amyloidosis? What are these patients referred to you with before a correct diagnosis is established?
Well, you know, it's tricky. Definitely in the whole amyloidosis space, you know, cardiologists and particularly heart failure specialists talk a lot about ATTR. And, you know, in that case, you have imaging characteristics that you see on echo or MRI or even EKG that, you know, can tip you off that amyloidosis may be present. The problem is that in ATTR, you know, you don't have that sense of urgency necessarily. You know, you can kind of take your time to make the diagnosis. But honestly, to get to the diagnosis of ATTR, you have to go through the evaluation of AL first, because all of the basic tests, they're not as specific, you know, even echo or MRI or amyloidosis scan. Those tests are only truly accurate in terms of detecting amyloidosis. They're not accurate in terms of distinguishing the two. So I think that it's absolutely important that if you're suspicious of amyloidosis at any level, that you need to do the appropriate evaluation for AL really as fast as possible to make the diagnosis or exclude it.
How common is it for a patient to be referred to you with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or hypertensive cardiomyopathy, and that was an incorrect diagnosis and it was infiltrative cardiomyopathy amyloid?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I would say that it's pretty common. You know, an estimate would be 5 or 10% of people that you're seeing that have some evidence of heart failure, and maybe they have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy by some test, that in the end, roughly about 10% of those will ultimately end up with a diagnosis of amyloidosis. So if you have a patient that you're being sent that has hypertrophy on an echo image or some other image, then, you know, you need to make sure that amyloidosis is not present in a fairly expeditious way. So I think, you know, you can't just sit on that one and say, I'll treat whatever existing hypertension may be there or give them a diuretic and follow them up in 6 months. That's not good enough.
I'm going to share my screen for a moment because I'm going to discuss a patient. And Professor Wekelekar actually alluded to this a bit earlier. And this is a patient of mine who was found to have a monoclonal IgA kappa protein, small M spike, that's 13 grams per liter in US, 1.3 grams per deciliter, an IgA of under 2000 milligrams per deciliter. The urine was not measured because the patient was assumed to have a monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. And let's just put that onto presentation mode. And she diddled around for a year. And the problem here is that the patient did not have evidence of any CRAB criteria. Calcium normal, renal function normal, no bone lesions, no anemia. But when she came for a second opinion, her symptoms, which were not CRAB, included weight loss of 30% of her body weight, inability to feel her feet, recurrent syncope, diarrhea, and systolic hypotension. And this patient, who had a positive fat aspirate, a positive bone marrow on the right for Congered, and in the middle, a lip biopsy, died 3 months later of her advanced GI and cardiac amyloidosis. And I'll stop sharing. And Professor Wekelekar, can you just briefly discuss amyloid kind of masquerading as mucus and smoldering myeloma?
So if I get a question rightly, this is early suspicion of amyloidosis in a patient with mucus or smoldering myeloma. So most patients with AL amyloidosis will have a pre-existing gammopathy for some time. And we have a chance of detecting these patients developing amyloidosis if we do the right tests. the two or three common organs which are involved in amyloid typically tend to be the heart and the kidneys. And then, of course, you do have the involvement of the gut and the nerves. So symptoms such as unexplained fatigue, unexplained weight loss, early satiety in an MGUS patient should certainly raise red flags. A simple urine test for albuminuria would also be quite valuable in patients where there are atypical features, particularly lambda light chain MGUS. This patient has started losing weight in the setting of an MGUS, which would automatically trigger a red flag well follow-up. The challenge is that most MGUS patients will have their bloods tested every 6 months, every 12 months, every 18 months, and in between it's forgotten. The other interesting bit with this patient is what often gets forgotten with MGUS is not to test for the light chain or urine for Benz-Jones proteinuria, because again, that would be a suspicion. Patients with light chain MGUS with high light chains, particularly the lambda variant, are more likely to have a risk of developing amyloidosis than those with probably normal serum-free light chains.
What do you see as the current standard of care for patients in the US and Europe, and what is your goal of therapy?
So our current standard of care for patients with systemic AL amyloidosis is directed at the underlying plasma cell clone, MGUS, smoldering myeloma or myeloma. The daratumumab with cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, the DARA-VCD regimen, which was studied in the Andromeda clinical trial, a randomized phase 3 trial randomizing patients to daratumumab VCD versus VCD, clearly showed the superiority of DARA-VCD in achieving hematologic responses in these patients, which led to this being licensed as a treatment for newly diagnosed patients with AL amyloidosis. And currently, this would be the first-line standard of care for majority of the patients with AL amyloidosis. Patients with limited organ involvement would still be potential candidates for an autologous stem cell transplant, but less and less patients are getting an upfront stem cell transplant, and most of the patients will get an induction treatment, often with DARA-VCD, and then some patients will proceed to a transplant. Our goal of therapy is to reduce the clonal light chains to as low a level as possible, ideally achieving a very good partial response, which is the difference between the involved and uninvolved light chains of less than 40 milligrams per liter, or a complete response, which means normal light chains and no detectable monoclonal protein in the serum and urine. As we understand amyloidosis better, it is becoming more and more apparent that complete response is probably our goal of treatment in most cases. We really don't have agents which help us to remove the amyloid protein deposits, so we are just targeting the precursor and then expecting that the amyloid deposits will spontaneously regress.
Dr. Lenihan, 70% of AL amyloidosis patients and nearly 100% of ATTR amyloid patients have cardiac involvement. And could you talk to me and our audience about the management of the cardiomyopathy and the associated rhythm disturbances these patients have?
Yeah, this is a very challenging scenario, because depending on the extent of amyloidosis involvement, you know, these problems become more and more difficult. What commonly happens, or at least certainly in my observation, is when people are diagnosed with AL amyloidosis, the beginning part of their treatment, you may deal with hypotension on a pretty significant basis. And so what you're trying to do is support them through that. So commonly we have to use medications like midodrine or even droxidopa to try to manage their hypotension that is partially related to peripheral neuropathy, but also to autonomic dysfunction. So these are sort of counterintuitive. When you have somebody who's developing heart failure, usually you want to use vasodilators and beta blockers and these types of traditional therapy for usual heart failure. You cannot use those medications in these patients. And frequently what you have to do is use a combination of diuretics, but also these other medicines to support their autonomic dysfunction. Now, as their treatment goes along, especially if they're responding well to the plasma cell-based treatment, then usually these medications can be gradually weaned off. But those are real challenges, trying to manage somebody's hypotension during induction-type therapy. And then in terms of rhythm problems, I mean, that is super difficult and complex individual based, you know, challenge in every patient. So AFib is a common problem. There's a certain rate of ventricular tachycardia and sudden death that may occur. Some people wonder whether that's primarily just a rhythm disturbance, and other people may argue that it is the myocardium is not responsive to whatever stimuli you're giving it. So if they, even if they have a defibrillator in place, they may still die anyway because of inadequate myocardial capture of the device. So I think that these are very challenging questions. And, you know, when you're talking about how to manage rhythm problems in these patients, you really do have to individualize what exactly their situation is and how aggressive are you going to try to be to correct atrial fibrillation, for example. And then, of course, this definitely brings in the whole concept of anticoagulation into the mix. And anticoagulation is a very important concept in these patients, partially because of the disease, but also because of the treatments that they're getting.
You mentioned not using afterload reduction or beta blockers in patients with cardiac amyloid. What happens exactly?
Well, I mean, for the most part, it's their blood pressure is already borderline, and you give them some sort of vasodilator, or in the case of a beta blocker, you're reducing their ability of their heart to compensate for a low blood pressure. So you're reducing the heart rate response. And so these patients, and then, like I said, they also have problems with autonomic dysfunction. So you're really just kind of adding fuel to that fire. And for the most part, you know, there may be occasions where you would use a beta blocker in such a patient, but it's a challenge. And if you do use them, you got to be very careful.
Professor Wekelikar, you mentioned specifically on the treatment to light chain production. Could you talk about the investigational horizon regarding the use of experimental therapies? And I'd like you to touch on, if you would, bortezomib, the Calium antibody, and the Atralis imaging / therapeutic approach.
Thank you. Thank you, Maury. So I think our goal really is to remove the fibrils that are damaging the tissues. And it has been very well shown in experimental models that if we use monoclonal antibodies to tag the fibrils, it identifies them to the immune system. That then triggers the macrophages to hopefully clear the fibrils very rapidly in animal models. And we have the three agents that you mentioned. Bortezomib is the one that is most advanced. It's a anti-fibril antibody, which also binds to the misfolded prefibrillar aggregates. And in the post-hoc analysis of the phase 3 clinical trial that Maury, you just published, along with all of us in Blood, showed that in patients with advanced stage 4 cardiac amyloidosis, bortezomib showed a significant survival benefit, which also translated into a significant functional benefit in terms of quality of life in 6-minute walk test. So this antibody is now currently undergoing a further phase 3 confirmatory clinical trial with a 2-to-1 randomization between bortezomib to standard of care along with chemotherapy. The Calium antibodies are also antifibril antibodies, and in early phase 1 and phase 2 studies, they've also shown evidence of cardiac and renal responses in patients with AL amyloidosis. Two large phase 3 clinical trials have now completed recruitment. One of the studies looked at patients with very advanced cardiac amyloidosis, the so-called European Mayo stage 3B disease, where there's very, very poor prognosis. And the second trial looked at patients with stage 3A disease. So these trials have now completed recruitment, and we're awaiting the results. And the last agent that you mentioned, the Atralis program, is a small peptide, which initially was developed as an imaging agent for amyloidosis. It is an agent which binds to all types of amyloid rather than just AL amyloid fibrils, and at least in the early studies, seems to be a very novel agent which can image amyloid deposits in the heart, liver, spleen, kidneys, and even soft tissue amyloid deposits. This small peptide has then been conjugated to a monoclonal antibody so that the peptide will bind to the fibrils, the antibody will trigger the immune response. And in theory, this could potentially be applicable to all amyloid types. And this is now undergoing phase 1 clinical trials And we look forward to the early results to see where this goes further. So at the moment, we've got a number of exciting agents that have either completed or are in phase one to phase three clinical trials, which may help us to clear the deposits, so trigger an acceleration of the clearance of the amyloid deposits. I think we've lost your sound, Maury.
Do you have any reflections on the Vijay Hem-Onc audience regarding which patients should be given standard of care locally and when they should be referred for participation in a clinical trial?
That is a difficult one to answer, because I think my bias is that if there is an available clinical trial with an antifibril antibody, we should refer all patients to available clinical trials. The challenge is that this is a rare disease, and often the trials are running in large centers which may not be geographically accessible to patients. And sometimes the sickest patients who may benefit the most from clinical trials may not be able to access these clinical trials. But I would certainly urge any of the listeners that if they have any newly diagnosed patients with AL amyloidosis, please think of a local trial center before you start treatment, because a lot of these trials are upfront trials. And once they've started chemotherapy, you cannot enroll the patients in the clinical trials.
Perhaps a phone call to your local amyloidosis center to make the inquiry regarding eligibility before therapy initiates?
I completely agree.
Questions for both of you. I'll have you answer in turn, starting with Dr. Lenihan. And what do you see as the role of the cardiologist in treating patients with amyloidosis? Where do you see how you fit in accurate diagnosis and the initiation of appropriate therapy?
Yes, I would love to answer this question in some detail, but before I do, I would just like to echo what was just said about if you make a diagnosis of AL amyloidosis and you are not in a major center, that you reach out, you know, immediately before treatment, because just like Ashutosh said, most of the current studies that thankfully are enrolled, but when there was a restriction in enrollment after, you know, once you started chemotherapy, you were not able to enroll those patients. So I think that having a good line of communication with a referral center is absolutely essential. So if you're in a smaller location and you are astute enough to make an early diagnosis, which is great, then, as you said, pick up the phone and contact your local or most local referral center. That's a critical step. As far as, you know, what we can do to be involved in this is, so, you know, the truth is if you think about it from a patient point of view, you know, a patient may present with profound weight loss like the case that you had, but chances are that the condition has existed for a long time for that to be the manifestation. Now, what usually happens, and I would say more than 50% of the time, is that a patient begins to have fatigue and perhaps edema, these types of nonspecific findings. And they may or may not get admitted to a hospital and given diuretics in a diagnosis of heart failure. And so where cardiologists can step in is in that setting, if it's not easily explained by some other cause, the fatigue and edema, that you should consider amyloidosis and make the diagnosis as quickly as possible. So where cardiology would really help out in this setting is early diagnosis. And then once you make the diagnosis of AL amyloidosis, you are definitely going to be calling one of you guys and say, okay, we need to get going here. And that's so where cardiologists really could be the front line, basically. So you're going to be the patient, you're going to be the provider that on average the patient is encountering first.
Professor Wekelekar, really the same question for you, how you see your role as the hematologist in accurate diagnosis and therapy in patients with amyloidosis?
I think as a hematologist, we see a lot of patients with monoclonal gammopathies and smoldering myeloma who are at risk of developing amyloidosis. So it's really important that we keep our level of suspicion high in these patients if they develop unusual symptoms like peripheral neuropathy, autonomic neuropathy, unexplained non-selective proteinuria or albuminuria, or as Dr. Lenahan said, heart failure without a good explanation. We need to think about amyloid. We need to refer on to the appropriate specialists, arrange for the imaging, or consider biopsies. And then when the patient is diagnosed with amyloidosis, hematologists end up with a central role because chemotherapy still remains the mainstay of treating these patients. And we have to learn to be hematologists, but we have to work with the support of our cardiology colleagues, as a lot of these patients are in heart failure with hypotension, with arrhythmias, and therefore the chemotherapy itself may sound relatively straightforward, but supporting the patients during chemotherapy, managing their blood pressure, managing their fluid overload, managing their hypotension and their cardiac rhythm disturbances often makes a big difference to early survival. And I think a lot of patients will die or have hospital admissions if these things are not managed properly.
As we move into just kind of summarizing our thoughts, Professor Wekelekar, if you could just reflect on why a multidisciplinary approach is so important. Your group is really well known for having cardiology integrated into your group. Dr. Fontana comes to mind, of course, and others. But I'd just like, as we finish up, discussion a little bit about your collaboration with cardiology in managing patients.
We find it invaluable to work as a multidisciplinary team. It not only helps us to diagnose amyloid patients, but it also helps us to monitor these patients very, very closely with a number of different imaging modalities and evaluation methods that the cardiologists use, but also from a renal perspective with our nephrology colleagues and addressing all the complex multi-system problems these patients have. Each one of the specialties brings a slightly different perspective to the patient. And therefore, it is really important to have somebody who's experienced. And as Dr. Lenahan said, managing heart failure in an amyloid patient breaks the traditional boundaries of heart failure management. You cannot use the standard drugs. You have to use a different approach. And therefore, having cardiologists with an interest or expertise in amyloidosis certainly gives a different angle to how you can diagnose as well as treat these patients, in addition to tracking the amyloid protein deposits.
Dr. Lenahan, you work in an area in Cape Girardeau where there's some really quite well-known hematologists, Dr. Dickey, Dr. Moore. Could you discuss how you collaborate with your hematologist colleagues in order to effectively optimize care for these patients?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite topics, of course, is, you know, with what Ashutosh said, you know, it's essential that you have a multidisciplinary team. And so if I am talking to my cardiology colleagues and I'm asking them to be aware of this condition and do the initial investigations, whatever they may be. So it's frequent that, for example, I might order serum-free light chains and they're abnormal. And immediately I would ask my hematology colleagues to help not only interpret those results, but, you know, guide us in terms of what's the next step. So it's essential, and you have to have a close collaboration, whether it's by, you know, some sort of email messaging service or whatever, or, you know, text to their cell phone or however you best communicate. But that has to be a immediately available process so that you can really do an expeditious evaluation. But then as you're undergoing treatment, as Ashutosh also said, you know, the managing the rhythm issues and the blood pressure issues and all of that is a daily challenge.
Professor Wekelekar alluded to the use of the free light chain assay as being critically important in patients with monoclonal gammopathy undetermined significance. As a cardiologist, how have you incorporated measurement of the light chain into your practice, into your workflow as patients are referred with cardiomyopathies?
This is also a great question, but I would say we haven't talked about cardiac biomarkers as of yet on this call, but the you know, cardiac biomarkers are an essential piece in making the diagnosis. But I would also add, obviously, that serum free light chains are as well. So whenever I have a patient who has heart failure that doesn't quite fit the normal explanation of heart failure that we typically see, then I will do cardiac biomarkers and serum free light chains, and then serum protein immunoelectrophoresis. Those are standard tests from just a cardiologist perspective. The problem is that once those tests come back, if they're, you know, not the cardiac biomarkers, but certainly the protein electrophoresis comes back and it has an abnormality, that's where you really need to have a close collaboration. But certainly measuring cardiac biomarkers is an early step. It is not uncommon that you would hear a story where a patient came in, maybe with some degree of heart failure, and they measured a troponin, for example, and it was mildly elevated. And they repeated that test and it was still mildly elevated. And, you know, then they look down the coronary artery disease pathway and they don't really find anything revealing. And then they say, well, it must be nothing. It must be a false positive. And yeah, we cannot explain it away that way. I think that something like a mildly elevated troponin could be the, you know, the sentinel mark of amyloidosis. And so you can't let that one slide.
We're smiling simply because we've seen that quite frequently. Just because of our audience being hematologists and oncologists, what are the cardiac biomarkers?
Well, the two most studied and sort of make up the Mayo classification system are troponin T and NT-proBNP. So those are the Mayo Clinic originally proposed a staging scale, I think it was in 2012, and then revised it a little bit later. But those are the markers that they use in their, you know, basic analysis. BNP, which is a different version of a natriuretic peptide, and then troponin I have been investigated at other institutions and probably also have utility. The challenge is that if we just talk about those two markers, they started out as whatever they were. And then five generations later, we have super ultra sensitive troponins, et cetera. So if you probably don't want to get into those weeds, but basically troponin and NT-proBNP would be the most important markers that we need to know about.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lenihan. And I want to thank our viewers. And on behalf of VJ Heme Onc, I'm delighted that you chose to tune in and view this important presentation on the diagnosis and management of amyloidosis. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at VJ Heme Onc and subscribe to VJ Heme Onc podcasts on Spotify, Apple, and Podbean. Until next time.